Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to the Lifebook Member Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. Parenting Month. Got a wonderful bonus interview. One of my favorite people to speak to about development, about beliefs. Carista Luminaire is on the line. How are you doing, Carista?
I'm doing great.
So excited to speak with you today. Before we get started, Confused About Love is your website for everyone who heard her on the last belief clearing. It was a big hit. Thank you so much, Carista, for doing that.
You're welcome. This is actually, what we're talking about today is one of my older websites. It's quite archaic. I haven't really revived it in a while, but that also can be, you can see my work on creativeparenting.com.
Creativeparenting.com. Interesting. You're so well-versed for the topic today, the very niche topic, something I've been interested in for some time now. I want to talk about how children develop their intimacy behaviors, and I want to talk about how far back it reaches all the way into the prenatal science, which I'm just so fascinated by. Where do you want to start, Carista? You want to talk about, why don't you talk a little bit about the prenatal development first?
Yeah, well, just to give you a little brief background of where I've gathered all this information. I was one of the first attachment specialists. I actually coined a term called preconception bonding. And wow. I was one of the very first early prenatal conception, preconception prenatal before birth researchers inspired by the early work of Tom Verney. And I was involved with an association for pre and perinatal psychology and health way back in the 80s before it was hip. And Tom, his book, The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, came out, and I knew I really dovetailed with my passion to try to understand how to actually prepare for parenthood and bring a child into the world from the get-go knowing it was loved and wanted, because the research showed that even in the womb, a child knows if it's wanted or not. And I thought, what is a better way to really optimize human development than to develop a model that would help prospective parents understand how to prepare for their future child and optimize its well-being. So I created, out of my dissertation, a book called Parenting Begins Before Conception, A Guide to Preparing Body, Mind, and Spirit for You and Your Future Child. And out of that, began to study the attachment research. And then it was 20 years later that the attachment research really showed a correlation between early childhood attachment styles and adult intimacy dynamics. And that's where Lyon and I talked about kind of those who didn't get this kind of care and attachment from their parents pre-birth and post-birth, how you can really heal yourself from parents who didn't know how to give a secure attachment. But today we're talking primarily about when attachment begins. And certainly we know from the science that of the last four decades, many researchers have studied the behavior of babies in the womb by using ultrasound devices, so you can perceive their reactions to certain stimuli. And we know that the child in utero is a very sensitive being who responds to overt stimulation from the inner and outer environment of the mother, as well as her interaction with other people. So her relationship to the primary attachment partner of the mother, be it a woman or man, also affects the mother and thus the child.
Wow.
And yeah, it's you know, I could go into detail what some of that science is if you'd like to do that.
I would love to.
Yeah, so we know the that in this research that a baby in the womb has developed the emotional and intuitive sensitivity to experience the mother's inner and outer life. Why do we know that? Because we can see in ultrasound that the child can hear the mother's voice and senses her love or not. So if she's upset, if she's having an anger cycle, we can actually see in the womb the child actually, in a sense, bathes in the mother's emotional state. So if she goes into high distress, which affects the cortisols and the adrenals, the child will actually go into a triggered reaction as well. We see the child kind of, you know, go into a contraction. And we also know the prenatal research shows that the unborn child can see and hear, remember, taste, and think before and during the birth. So by the fourth month, it's developed a sense of vision and touch. It will suck its lips. You know, if it's stroked, it will shield its eyes if a bright light shines on the mother's womb. And by the fifth month, it will raise its hands to cover its ears if there's a loud sound. So that means the child can be emotive, capable of communicating his or her aversion to the parent's behavior. You know, and we know that researchers have discovered that babies began hearing as early as the 18th week of pregnancy, is that distinctive musical preferences. In London, there was a maternity hospital where preborns were given musical exposure 4 to 5 months old, and they were restless when exposed to the intensity of hard rock music, and Vivaldi and Mozart, however, seemed to calm them down.
Wow.
So measuring brain waves in prenates has shown, you know, by 7th month, and bottom line, we know that the mother's voice to her preborn, you know, the child is bathing in that voice. And so therefore, you know, as we watch, the heart rate of the preborn can double when the mother's frightened. It becomes important for the mother to realize she can actually protect the child from some of the adverse stress. And the last point I want to make in this first reflection, Jordan, is that I, as a mom who, you know, wrote a doctoral dissertation, a master's thesis, a book, had a parenting center, when I got pregnant, I was just like everyone else. Life is stressful, you know, and life happens. So this is not about instilling guilt or shame or judgment for those mothers and fathers who had a tumultuous pregnancy and therefore the child is scarred for life, because children are very resilient. It's really to see that if there was significant trauma where the dominant experience was high stress, not just the everyday, you know, anger here, upset there, fear that pregnant mothers go through, but mm-hmm. there's a dominant 9 months, the dominant experience was of extreme stress and adversity, ambivalence about having the child, then the child may have been impacted in terms of its sense of security, particularly if that continued after the birth.
And it all plays into the soup, right? It's not all nature or all nurture. We were talking
exactly.
on another episode about something Nathaniel Brandon kind of coined. He said, because I was talking to all the different guests on Parenting Month about people who form beliefs and how if you perpetuate your beliefs onto your kids, it creates this cycle. But what's interesting is sometimes there will be 4 kids who all have the same, you know, let's just say crappy, aggressive, abusive, alcoholic dad. 3 of them go on to repeat. 1 of them doesn't. Why is that?
That's right.
And Nathaniel Brandon said he had a term that he coined called the untouchables. If you take a look at certain people, I think Oprah was an example that he gave. If you look at how horrible their past was, they should never have had made it out of that. But something about them made them untouchable. And maybe that's a little bit of nurture, maybe a little nature, maybe a combination of both that kind of mixes us into the cosmic soup that we are as people. You know what I mean?
Yes, in my particular way of exploring Oprah for a good, you know, public example, I mean, she definitely talked about how a lot of her weight challenges were a reflection of some of that trauma, and her question about whether to be a mother or not. So, untouchable. I understand he's saying kind of generically that they're really resilient beings who, even though they're exposed to a lot of trauma, can end up being very productive, healthy individuals.
Seemingly whatever you throw at them. I know a couple people like this. It's like this guy
I do too.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Myself included.
Nice.
You know,
I like that.
So I understand if people knew the amount of trauma I've experienced this lifetime, I can say with great authority personally, as well as working as a trauma specialist, that one can heal themselves and actually, you know, become stronger and more resilient as a result. In other words, a lot of my work came out of realizing what I didn't receive, even though my parents really intended to give me a wonderful life. It wasn't their intention, because of their patterning and such. You know, I had some difficulties as well as some outside abuse that happened unbeknownst to them from childhood babysitters, etc. But some beings actually use their wounding to say, you know, I will make sure I will never repeat this. I'm going to really, you know, change this branch of the family tree.
They often go the opposite direction.
I will make sure I'm not verbally abusive to my child.
I'll never touch alcohol again.
Exactly. So that is the blessing of those who had enough self-awareness, personal work, enough consciousness to say, I would never want to repeat this.
Where do you think that comes from? Do you think some people are born with it?
Well, you're asking me when you don't know when element of my training, as well as I went to a very traditional Harvard psychology major, but my nature and my life's work has led me to understanding a lot about esoteric psychology. My book has a lot of esoteric information in terms of understanding we come in we're born as souls who actually come into a particular circumstance for the evolution of the soul. And that is working with the principles of karma and reincarnation, which for some people is really, you know, too far-fetched. And I never impose that on anyone because we have enough to work through this lifetime. We don't even need to include it. But if you're asking me my honest truth about what I believe, having done a lot of academic study, even on the principles of reincarnation through the seven major mystic traditions, I would say that for those who believe in the soul consciousness, that some souls come in with certain attributes, talents, gifts, as well as karma that they've come to work through that is not just of this lifetime. And so their intelligence is nature, nurture, and, you know, soul-infused kind of
imprint.
Forces that...
Yeah.
Right. So if I could just ground a little bit... So I had a lot of abuse this lifetime, even with highly educated, loving parents who, you know, when they found out were absolutely tormented by it. And when I was a childhood babysitter, I didn't end up telling my parents till later in life. And I'd say a great part of the inspiration behind my life's work was I had memories of not just this life, but other lives of abuse. And I had enough memory to know that I would then spend my entire adult life, starting at 21, just really creating teachings and healing modalities to help people with being able to prevent abuse in relationships and or heal from it. And I know that came not just from this incarnation. But I've got enough in this lifetime that even if that was just some, you know, magical projection that I had earlier experiences my soul did to kind of, to reconcile misuse of power, you know, ignorance around what love is and what it isn't, I would say knowing enough about myself that it came from earlier experiences of my soul's incarnations. And
super,
I've got plenty of data this lifetime. Yeah.
So fascinating.
It doesn't really matter.
I love it.
Yeah.
You're right here at home at Lifebook, though. We are welcome to all sorts of talk. Just because there's so much diversity here and the community is so loving and open, we love talking about it, man. And we love talking to you. And we appreciate you opening up, too. Really.
Thanks.
Really quite
Thanks.
Inspiring.
I want to
talk about where the behaviors come from. When people enter these love relationships in life, a lot of the times they're like pre-programmed robots, and they're not even sure why. The saddest thing is when some people never become conscious of this stuff. I mean, there's so many levels to consciousness. You're so inundated with it that you're so deep into it. But first of all, where do these behaviors come from? And then follow-up question, do you feel for those who never really wake up to their patterns and behaviors and beliefs?
Of course. I mean, one can only feel compassion when one sees, as a healer, you know, people suffering from ignorance and really lacking the understanding why they keep repeating patterns of behavior that are hurtful, harmful, traumatic, threatening, and have no, you know, approach, no guidebook, no one they trust to say, hey, you know, this is just lack of wisdom, ignorance, how, you know, what love is supposed to feel like and what it isn't, what creates a healthy relationship. So, I mean, all you have to do is pick up the news, watch the news, and, you know, half of our civilization is completely ignorant or more in terms of what, you know, of their behaviors and how to, particularly when they're in vicious cycles of, you know, abuse or harm, self-harm, banning the self, you know, they can actually heal that. They can heal great trauma. You know, some people are born in collective trauma where war zones and such, where even if they're awake, they can't escape, you know, or family systems where they're dependent on their parents and they can't escape the addiction or abuse or, you know, threatening behaviors of their parents. But as adults, we can, if we find the right allies, mentors, teachers, healers, you know, bodies of work, there is a path to heal the deepest, most significant developmental trauma or acute trauma. One needs to know that you can actually heal it as it lives in your body. You can heal the memories. You can change the beliefs, as Lion has been offering. And you have to find the right, you know, people to really walk you through kind of feeling a safe container to feel what feels threatening. I mean, that's always what I'm listening for. you know, where the distress is in an individual or a couple or a family dynamic, because that points to where the ignorance is, where the lack of wisdom to know how to feel safe and secure, you know, loved, and be able to be one's true self is always the symptom is distress. Because when we are feeling safe and secure, not threatened, when we are feeling we can be our authentic true selves, you know, we're out of distress. And so those are really the criteria. It's very simple for me what I'm diagnosing and what the path of recovery is to the true self. I also have a body of work called at trueself.net, because if you look at all my different brands, of which I have 5 or 6 since I was 21, I'm now 63, they're all really, even their early parenting work is how do we support parents in healing some of their childhood issues before they become parents, so that they're oriented to support the true nature, the true self of the child from conception onwards. And that really is what parenting, you know, creative parenting, conscious parenting is to me, is to inspire parents to realize that the child was not born to be an extension of their agenda, what works for them, but the child is a unique being with its own patterns and its own purpose to fulfill this lifetime as an expression of its true self.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And they're set up to be little repetition machines, right? I mean, obviously, if your parents have a loving relationship, that's where you pick up your behaviors and vice versa. But there's like a whole bunch of stuff in between, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's like monkey see, monkey do.
Yes and no and yes and sometimes.
Right.
You know, having had a major parenting center called the Center for Creative Parenting in Marin County for 15 years, where we had people would come pre-conception all the way up to 3 years. We had six new baby groups, and then we had 6 to 12, and then we had 1 to 3 years old, and I could study a lot of the early parenting as well as my practice working with those going through this process and being a mom myself. It all adds up to if the parents are aware that the child's purpose for coming to the world is to fulfill its own destiny, then the child is, and the child has secure attachment. In other words, it knows it's safe and loved, and it can trust one or both parents, or if it has two parents, or primary caregivers, or step parents, or adoptive parents, or, you know, then it's more apt to be able to stay connected to its true nature. In other words, it's not going to go into adaptive survival strategies to cut off from its self-expression because it's feeling dangerous to reveal who it really is. That's what creates the developmental trauma. If the parent is basically negating the child's nature, particularly if it's different than the parents. So so love is not enough. Love is critical. There are lots of parents who claim they love their children and smother them, suffocate them, and control them in the name of love. So love, you know, genuine love is, you know, I'm here to love you as with who you are and what you need to be who you are, and I'm going to stay very vigilant. Let me give you a personal example. So my daughter, who's now almost 24, she came to me. She went through college prep. Ivy League background myself, you know, her dad also, you know, highly educated. She was not really driven academically at school. She's her strength is interpersonal intelligence, and she's really worldwide. She's a remarkable being, but academics wasn't her main, you know, priority. Mm-hmm. So she, you know, gave her some support to get into colleges, hiring some this, that, and, you know, she got into 6 colleges, and she came into my bedroom the day we were going to go and visit them, and she came and she goes, Mom, I don't want to go to any of the 6 colleges I got into. And by the way, I was a film major in high school because Dad was, you know, into film and something I really, you know, thought I was interested in. But I'm not interested in film at all in terms of my life's work. I'm really interested in fashion. I've had this 4-year secret life where I've been studying fashion, you know, and that's where I really want to go, to a fashion school. And she hadn't applied to any fashion schools. And it was in that moment I realized, okay, Krista, here's your initiation. You know, all these years of this work with parents and about supporting the child and being true to itself. And she was really, she was coming from her core, terrified of disappointing me and her dad. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget the moment. It was like, okay, you know, I need to give her the experience to trust her sense that these schools she applied to, pressure from counselors, you know, pressure from friends, perhaps from her parents.
TV, society, everywhere.
Yeah. Fierce. You know, and it was like, okay, I got it. What are you going to do? And she goes, I'm going to take a year off and, you know, work in this fashion.
Oh, so smart.
And so we just said, okay. And then she ended up going to fashion school, you know, and then again, she got out of fashion school and she's like, you know, I'm not sure fashion's my path.
But that's so important to make that step because some people get locked into something and they're there for decades.
Exactly.
So it's like, exactly. It's all about sending them on their own progression, I guess. And that's the big link that you just put in here for me, because Carissa, I have a kind of a theory. I'm a new parent, mm-hmm. so I can't say that I know this from experience, but having spoken to a lot of parents and, you know, done the Lifebook podcast for so long, I kind of had this ongoing theory that if you love your kid and you provide them a safe, loving environment, that's 90% of the battle. And you just added another layer on that, which was you also can't impose your own stuff on them. You can love them to death and still impose your stuff. So you just kind of upgraded my whole theory, which is, and would you agree that what you described before, first of all, a loving, safe environment combined with not understanding that they're on their own path and your job is to help them develop that own path. Do you believe that's like 90% of the battle when it comes to anything, independence, competence, grades, just anything? Is that 90% of it?
Yeah, I mean, we're listening, right? So we want to give them our best. We want a role model. They're going to absorb lots, you know, over time, subliminally, whether we mean to or not. Some of, you know, I always said to my daughter, when you want to go to therapy, I'll be glad to pay for it. Even with, you know, a dissertation on the subject, parenting center, all the credentials, like, I'm human, you know, and so is their dad. And therefore, you know, it's just a complete willingness to be constantly adjusting to what the child, the signals of what the child feels is true for them. So, yes, I gave her, you know, piano lessons because everyone was doing it. And then after 6 months, she didn't like piano. I wouldn't force her to because she really didn't like it. Then I gave her flute lessons because I played flute. I gave her my childhood silver flute and she didn't like it. I put her in soccer and she didn't like it, but she loved dance. And then it, you know, she went dance for 12 years and then woke up one day and said, I'm done with dance. Now, what I care about is that she's being honest what interests her. She's telling me what her passions are, and that, yes, she gets to change over time. Some of them are social pressure things that children do or parent pressure. And if she's really unhappy and it's not her nature to be sports-oriented or music-oriented, then that matters to me. You know, I gave her opportunities. And so then it's more like, what are you interested in? You know, what does light you up? And then let's create a container for that. And you know what? Yes, you get to change those interests over time because, you know, you may use the virtues of the discipline of taking dance for 10 or 12 years. And like myself, I took dance as a child and I'm a great dancer when I dance socially, you know, I'm confident, but I'm not a professional dancer. So I love that I got the training of dance, but it's not, you know, I just use it for enjoyment.
Oh, you have no idea.
Or the discipline of this.
Totally. I mean, yeah. I've been so into the synergy of human experience and human skill lately.
Yeah.
I used to make hip hop music, and that's why I'm a podcaster today. It's literally just directly translated into a passion that didn't exist when I was first making music. So it's important to not pigeonhole your kids, obviously, but I feel like I could talk to you for so long, Carissa. We're way off base here, and I love it. Let's just stay off base. You said something.
Go wherever you want to go.
You said something. You said, what are we focusing on, or what am I focusing on, or something like that. Yeah. Why don't you dive down on that? What is your goal for your kids? What is your number one attribute? What is your number one target?
Well, if you want them healthy, as healthy as possible, and this is for me, I'm 63. I've been into the true self notion before it was hip. Like I said, I have trueself.net. I've really been into, you know, what optimizes human development. It's very simple. It's almost everyone is fulfilled and happy when they're being true to themselves. And really, you know, they're healthy selves. They know themselves. They know what gives their life meaning. They know they have a positive sense of self-worth. They know, they trust, they know their talents that give them well-being and joy. They know their limitations. They know where they have, you know, intelligences that aren't classically academic, you know, like my daughter's very interpersonally intelligent, and you know,
most intelligences are, I think, not classically academic. Is that the case?
Yeah,
right?
There's spatial intelligence. There's like
12
nine.
Or
Kagan
nine?
Has
yeah, okay.
Nine, or 10 now, I think, is if you research Kagan's different distinctions of intelligence. And we can't be good at everything. That's the one thing I also told my child. And now I have a stepdaughter as well. But it's like, you don't, you know, she doesn't mind me talking about her publicly. I just talk about her because I've had my direct experience of this initiation.
Oh,
you
we
know?
Do it all the time on the Lifebook podcast. All the parents come on yeah. and gossip about their kids. It's great.
Yeah, but it's, you know, she and all the clients that I work with a lot of teens and young kids and families. It's really, you know, it's whatever the child is sharing in the moment lights them up. And that includes where they feel anxious and overwhelmed and their distresses. It matters. So when she didn't do well in a particular subject, even though she did well earlier in her life, my response was, sweetie, we all can't be good at everything. So let's look at where you excel. And if you'd like support, a tutor, more than happy to give you that. In order to optimize getting to certain colleges, you need their options. So, you know, you get to decide. We'll provide the support. And, you know, and then there's also trade schools where you won't need this ability if it's not really your passion and you don't want to, you know, excel in this area. So mm-hmm. it's really kind of listening for what they're saying, and suddenly, you know, she wakes up and she's living in LA and she goes, I have this instinct, I'm supposed to go to New York, there's not enough keeping me in LA, I love this and that, but it's like, I'm only 23, my gut's telling me to go. It's like, what else am I going to say in supporting her and being true to herself, but listen, mm-hmm. you know, try it out. If you don't like it, then you can come home. Because that's what I mean by supporting the child's true self. It's like, when they're saying, this is where my spirit, my nature is calling me. This is where I feel meaning. And it starts very early on. It starts so early on that I can give one more example. When she was 7 and she months old, she wasn't even talking yet. She just started pulling up on the couch. She hadn't even started walking yet. And she was in her PlayStation. And I was on my computer, and it started to rain. I had to go get her diapers, and her dad wasn't home. And I grabbed her from her PlayStation, and she started crying hysterically. And it was at that moment, I write about this in my book, I realized, wait a minute, how would I feel if someone just grabbed me in the middle of my PlayStation in front of my computer, forced me to get dressed, and grabbed me out in the rain, and didn't ask me, didn't care how I felt about it, because I was in the middle of some creative moment. And I thought, you know what? We're equals. Your needs are as important as mine. Mm-hmm. I have to respect that you're upset because I just unilaterally grabbed you and you had no voice to negotiate. Hey, Mom, I need 5 more minutes, you know, to finish what I'm playing in. And it was just, I grew this very deep sensitivity and respect for her. You know, that to listen to where her distress was and what it meant, age appropriate, and where I was still the parent to guide her, where she didn't have enough wisdom, and where I could trust she had wisdom that I needed to listen to and respect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that, I think that's part of the healthy relationship. I loved that your answer was you're focusing on health, but you didn't go straight to diet and exercise. You talked about spiritual health and emotional health and self-esteem, living your purpose. Do you think that kids are struggling now with that more than ever? There's so much overwhelm combined with complacency, combined with, just because of how cushy society has become, not just for this generation, but just over time, exponentially. Everything's just getting better and better, and people are more and more complacent. It's just the nature of society. And I think that the kids are just totally, they're like deer in the headlights. They're stunned.
Yes. And, if you have 5 hours, I could really drill this one down. But I'll just say broad stroke. At the same time, unlike myself, who's 63, where there was no technology, and I grew up in the country, you know, I had a relationship with nature, with people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I am seeing that kids now really are losing interpersonal relationship skill building because they don't have to. On top of the fact that they're literally living off their phones, and I want to get into the EMF impact, but the you know, they're really not forced to be interpersonal. And so that's a skill set to develop. That's, you know, and that's attachment. And if their parents are very technologically oriented and they're seeing their parents at the meals or when they come home, you know, are really not relating to them, then they're missing a lot of the critical nourishment psychologically of what, you know, secure attachment is, which is basically there's a you in the relationship and there's a me. It's a two-party system, and together we create a we, and we impact each other. And without understanding interpersonal, you know, dynamics and how we impact each other, we create either safety and security where we're really there for each other and relationship is the priority, and we help each other in distress, and we empower each other's true self, and we're each other's go-to person, then a child never learns what secure love is, what healthy interpersonal love is. They're more apt to be more insecurely attached, and they learn to self-regulate. They may regulate off the computer when they're in distress, but there's no human interdependency. And that is the greatest danger in terms of what's happening in our civilization, because if we don't care about our impact on each other on a, you know, personal level with our family, friends, and we can't have that sensitivity how, you know, geopolitically what's happening, we're really in trouble as a civilization. So I'm really concerned about the younger generation and what's happening in terms of, you know, how technology is offering them all kinds of windows into realities we didn't have without it, right? You don't have to travel overseas anymore. You can watch it. And all kinds of wonderful YouTube education, teleseminars, things that are just amazingly accessible education-wise for all of us at every age. At the same time, interpersonally, we are getting very, very lazy, and many of us aren't developing skill sets, and children aren't, and they're living off of computers, which is a two-dimensional, you know, dynamic.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely a double-edged sword, but it's interesting what you're saying, which is it's the side effects, it's the weird byproducts that are causing some of these issues.
Pretty worrisome. It's very worrisome. I mean, the news is very scary, you know, and no matter what side of the fence you are, you know, you lean, there's so much hate, anger, negativity, polarization, that if you don't have an internal life, if the child isn't given an internal life to have access to his or her feelings and needs to stay well, to self-regulate, to know what healthy self-care is, to know how to be true to oneself, it's very, very easy to be impacted by what's happening outside of oneself, because there's no internal reality of feeling self-secure, secure in primary relationships to weather these threatening realities outside. You see, if we were really simplify it, besides the true self motif, the other one that I use a lot is really understanding what healthy relationship is, what love is and isn't. Because if we don't understand that when we're feeling threatened in a relationship or by something outside of our lives, we go into a fight or flight reaction. That's the great neuroscience of relationship data that's come out. If we're in fight or flight for any reason, we feel threatened by even our own beliefs, much less someone outside of us threatening us. We can't be well. In other words, when we feel threatened, we go into fight. Either we have to, you know, go after and stop that aggressor, that threatening something, thought, feeling, person, or we go into flight, we withdraw. And when we're in that reaction, we cannot actually be in a pro-relational well state, because the well state, to be true to ourselves, is actually a non-threatened part of our brain, the prefrontal lobes. That's where all the pro-relational ability to be collaborative with someone, to be appreciative, to be in mutuality, to, you know, really care about our impact on others, is when we're not in a threatened state. Otherwise, we're in survival. And that's why the prenatal work and the preconception work is to inspire parents to really parent their child to lower the threat and to care when the child's in distress, to help co-regulate the child's well-being. That's where the true self, we can't be true to ourselves when we're in a high state of threat or distress, because we're in survival. So that's a critical component. Mm-hmm.
Very, very enlightening stuff. What other strategies can we implement to strengthen our child's intimate behaviors down the road and make sure that they are you know, they have a healthy relationship with intimacy in general.
Oh, well, it's a little, I'm going to repeat from a different angle those two notions of our commitment that when the child feels safe and secure, it's the dominant experience with parents 80%+ of the time. I trust you're here for me. Of course, parents get preoccupied. There's other kids. Life happens, deaths and family.
80% plus. I like that.
Yeah. 4 to 5 interactions, the research says, in any given day, let's say.
That's a good bad average.
This is Gottman Institute. This is all the attachment research. That means that the child is not feeling threatened in a significant way in terms of one or both parents, optimally both, but at least one attachment figure is offering the sense of stability that, you know, you are my priority, creating security for you. You know, I'm here to soothe your distress when you're out in the jungle and it feels, and you come home, I'm your go-to person. That's called secure attachment. So those who have had secure attachment will be more apt to offer that to someone else than those who had an insecure attachment, which mm-hmm. Lai and I talk about the distinctions in that relationship podcast that you gave. They can understand that more or look at the Confused About Love website. We have those distinctions in the free love style profile quiz. The other is the child will be more intimate if it feels it can trust itself, it knows itself, it's got self-worth, which comes from primary caregivers, attachment figures, even grandparents, siblings, aunts, uncles, you know, mentor teachers, coaches that empower the child. That when you are feeling vulnerable, you're feeling distressed, that's what intimacy is. You can tell me, I will help you. You can share your underbelly, that's intimacy, as well as when you reveal your wonderful attributes, qualities, and true nature, I'm going to empower, you know, your capacity to be loving. My daughter would say something, mm-hmm. She'd be upset with a kid at school and go, you're so loving to feel that. You know, in other words, that's a good thing, you have this sensitivity. That's intimacy, mm-hmm. is to be able to share, you know, intimacy is when we feel we can be seen and heard and felt, or any combination of that, by someone else and feel safe revealing ourselves. So if you take that as one of the criteria, at least Carista's criteria, that comes from 40 years of attachment research and experience, that that's what we're trying to offer someone. When I feel intimate with someone, I feel like I can go to them and I can be my most, you know, darkest, most insecure, traumatized self. And they're like, I got you, honey. You know, mm-hmm. tell me, what are you feeling? Mm-hmm. What do you need to feel safe? You can be that open with me and that real, as well as I can say, I just did this amazing podcast with Jordan. I felt like I was, you know, giving my best, and I feel really great about it, you know, and the person goes, right on, girl. Like, Lai and I have this thing. It's like, you know, we say to each other when we kind of are excited about something, you know, you're brilliant. You know, it's like, I'm your cheerleader for life when you really share your brilliance, you know, and that's intimacy too. And then I can go to him and go, I'm scared, you know, I'm scared to do this or that. And he'll hold me, or my girlfriend will hold me, or my daughter will call me up and go, Mom, I hate this job. It's the worst one I've ever been in. She called me last week. You know, she's just moved to a different state. I'm like, that's important. You feel that way. Like, you aren't wired to be behind a computer 40 hours a day. You're an interpersonal person. You need relationships. Don't stay there. You know, mm-hmm. use it because you need the money, and look for something else. So that's intimacy. Like, you know, it's everything goes. It's like my best friend, we call each other BF 360s. It's like everything goes, and I'm here for you.
Don't you think being a parent is like, you're like a Swiss Army knife, and it's so hard to be good at all of those different facets. You're, you know, supporting the achievements and, nurturing them when they're down, knowing when to not nurture them when they're down, and when to pick them up and say, brush it off, you're fine. Like, you have to, it's quite a complicated task.
Oh, yes. I love you said that. It is. And like I said, you know, even with all my wisdom and my life's work being around conscious parenting, I say to my daughter, if you ever need therapy, you know, I'll pay for it. If you can't pay for it.
Yes, exactly.
Because all we can do is the best we can do with the awareness we have. We all are ignorant. We all have childhood conditioning that blinds us until our children trigger it.
Right.
I'll give another story on that one. And then the key is, here's what I always say to parents, you know, I say this with parents to be, as well as those who already feel like, oh my God, you know, I went through a traumatic period and I'm afraid my child was impacted or is being impacted. That is the greatest wisdom and gift of love you can offer, is that you care about this impact and you want to help them heal from it. So if I could offer one last example that I think really captures what I'm saying directly. When my daughter was about 15, our big thing was, you know, clean up the room, age appropriate. And at 15, it was like, okay, it's your room. I want to give you that sovereignty and autonomy, and it's my house. Mm-hmm. And I want to teach you the skill of organization. So how about you get to keep it as messy as you want, but once a weekend you have to clean it up. Okay, Mom. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. Of course, every weekend, what time are you going to clean up? 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock, what happened? Wouldn't be cleaned up. So there was one weekend where I really let it rip. I was furious. I'd given her the loving, then in the semi-frustrated, it's like, okay, first time loving, second time frustrated, third time, hey, you know, it's understandable. You are not fulfilling your agreement.
Three strikes, you're out, man.
You know? Right. So I yelled at her, and she collapsed on the couch. I'll never forget it. She looked so frightened. Oh. And she said to me, you're scaring me. And being a trauma specialist and attachment specialist, that mattered to me.
Yeah.
Even though I felt righteous, like, hey, I asked you lovingly once, twice, and, you know, I'm human, and you need to learn age appropriate. You have impact on me, too, and you didn't, you know, I've been really kind, and you've been ignoring me, and I'm human, and I'm frustrated. But do I want to frighten my child to that level of intimidation? No. So I stopped, and I spent about 2 hours with her talking about it, and you know, I had a rageaholic dad, so I knew what it was like to be frightened by rage, a raging parent. It mattered to me. But it was also, and it was also an opportunity to educate her. Hey,
yes,
this didn't come from nowhere. Like, look at all the times I started with love and you ignored me. And when you ignore someone, when you make an agreement, you know, they'll get frustrated and then they're rightfully feeling upset about it and angry.
Yeah, and they have to undergo this. That could be your boss in 10 years.
Exactly. So I cared for her feelings. I helped her. I owned the impact. I cared about the impact. And then I had to, in repairing it, I also wanted to educate her. And it's like, okay, age appropriate. What's the new agreement? Because I don't want to get angry. It hurts me. It's not good for me. And you don't want me to get angry. Then you have to look at what would keep me from getting angry.
Right.
So let's look at age appropriate, what the next agreement is. Let's write it down so it's trackable, and you can't say we didn't make that agreement. And you tell me what the natural consequence would be, rather than me imposing it as an authoritative parent. You tell me what the natural consequence would be if you don't fulfill your agreement. So she had some accountability what the consequence would be, and we wouldn't have to get into a big fight about it.
Yeah.
So that's an example.
It's parents' job to be triggered by stuff so that the kid can be properly prepared, triggered in a healthy way, which is hard, and then to ensure that the kid is prepared for similar triggers out in the real world. That's kind of what you're describing, right?
Yes, and the nuance I was offering is, even me, the one who's got all the credentials, I'll never forget. I mean, I hit a level of real rage. I was having a bad day, whatever. And it was also owning that I actually went overboard and caring about my impact.
That's hard. Some people will just deny it and won't fess up to the fact that they lost control. Right.
Yeah,
so that's the first step is like, and obviously you're so well versed, you could see it from a mile away, but it's like, that's the first step is being open enough to, right?
Yeah, but And we want to, if we want our kids to be accountable for when they lose it and they're rude and disrespectful to us, and we expect them to own it and repair it, and we give them a consequence for being rude and disrespectful and overwhelming us, who as the parent is going to role model that we too are human? And it's not that, the point is this, it's not that we all lose it at times. Because when we trigger, it happens in a nanosecond, even with all the wisdom.
Right.
It's how quickly we care to own and educate and repair with our child, to teach them that skill set that they can do it. We can do it with them and they can do it with us because we're all doing the best we can.
That's really great. That's a good point.
Yeah, that helps the child realize, hey, I don't have to go into shame that I, you know, hurt my parents or my sister, my brother. But yes, I do need to care, and I do want to learn I can own it and repair without being shamed. And the parent teaches the child how to take accountability by involving the child, age appropriate, of course, in what the consequence is going to be. So when she'd do other things younger, I'd sit down and I'd say, what do you think the consequence should be? Okay, now I want you to write it up. It may have just been, you know, in kindergarten, I'd write it for her. If I X, then I have to go in my room for 5 minutes. And if I Y, then I can't have a play date. So then, age appropriate. You know, that gives her power to know, or him power to know, to have some power with the consequences and be responsible for it. So it's, you know, I'm just giving some tips of ways that I learned and offer other parents as I work with them, how to really empower the child to take some responsibility for knowing, you know, what is healthy and what's not. Mm-hmm. And to then, we're all human, we're all learning together, you know, and sometimes the parents have to own that they actually stepped over the line and let the child see that and apologize for our adverse impact. And say, hey, together as a team, let's look at this. What's going on for you? Why aren't you cleaning your room I had some data on that. You know, why do I want you to clean your room? Hey, you have something to be educated about. Mm-hmm. Okay, now how do we find what's fair? That's what intimacy is. That's what it is. Now, if we have a boss or a parent who's authoritative, who doesn't care about our feelings and needs, then we have to know the difference, and sometimes we don't have a voice. We can't be seen, heard, and felt, and we have to decide, certainly once we're out of childhood, we have to decide how much we want to invest in those relationships, because we can't have real intimacy if they don't care about us and their impact.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long-winded reflection.
No, it was good. It's been fantastic, Krista. I feel like everything you're saying kind of adds up to me in a big argument for preparing for the family properly. Cause I mean, everything you're saying is like education and preparation and systems. Does a lot of what you're saying kind of point to, like, if possible, really preparing for parenthood and treating it like it's, I mean, Akira said something so great on his podcast. He was like, he recognized the gravity of from this moment forward, I'll be a parent forever. I mean, there's the rest of my life, and then there's when the kid came, and then the rest of my life. You know what I mean? So are you all for, like, preparation and family planning? Know what I'm trying to say.
You are talking to the pioneer in the world who wrote the book Parenting Begins Before Conception. That's the name of my book. Okay? So, it's for potential parents. Now, I'm going to say really clearly here, it's very important because it's a dilemma I had to deal with for 40 years since I wrote this. I started my doctoral dissertation, actually my master's thesis in 1980 on the subject, and then it became my book in 2000. It was way ahead of its time. Primarily, my biggest concern was, you know, for those who weren't able to give their child this, were they to feel guilty that they couldn't? They had high distress during the pregnancy or early parenting or later parenting. Are they to feel guilty and shameful that they've messed up their child? And absolutely not. As well as those who had difficult childhoods, are they therefore not going to be good parents? Absolutely not. They often make the best, as we said in the beginning, because they know what not to do. And I've been very vulnerable with my own process for this very reason. Even with this authoritative text and the academic credential behind it, I was in my human experience with all my reactions, all my developmental trauma, that a lot of it, like my raging father, who I internalized and took, you know, decades to dismantle, even that popped in when my daughter was 15 and became a teen. My, you know, a remnant of that conditioning, that's when she said, I'm scared of you, that's why I brought it up. Even with all the work I'd done on myself, I'm human. It was there in my subconscious. It came out. Now, the key is for any prospective parent or parent who's in any phase of parenting is when you discover that something in your behavior from your childhood or just your conditioning, nature, nurture, whatever it is harming your child. threatening your child's sense of well-being, threatening your child's self-worth, their true nature, get help. That's mm-hmm. all. That's the bottom line. If you feel it's over your head, that your reactions are just, you know, you don't know how to stop them, and you see your child's giving you signals that you could be hurting them or harming them even, just getting help, you are a conscious, loving parent. You're going for more wisdom to heal yourself.
Right, there are professionals
out there. Or get your child help.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, or send your child in to help or do family systems work, because there's great, you know, especially an attachment specialist or a developmental trauma specialist, and they're, you know, it's a hot field now. I'm not the only one. There's great practitioners out there, and now they can do online work. I work with people online all over the world I've never met. One can really heal that conditioning. You have to be willing to do the work. And even if you can't afford it financially, there's so many great online courses now that people can take in these areas of attachment. You can Google or developmental trauma or parenting, great parenting books, so parenting classes online. So there is help. It's such a prolific field now. This is the time. So anytime you choose to be a conscious parent, a caring parent, you can begin to repair. If you feel like you're conditioning, you know, you were ignorant, you're blind, and now you want to see, you have to, and you can repair. I work with adult children now. They fly in for intensives, adult children in their 30s and 40s with their adult parents who come to repair abuse that happened the first years. And mm-hmm. I even have step-parents coming in, first the mother, then the father, then the step-parents, of a 45-year-old who was traumatizing her newborn and her child because of the rage and the memories coming up from being abused as a child from really loving, educated parents who the father had an affair with a stepmother. And, you know, it just, the mother took it out on the child, and there we were, you know.
Right.
And she's now healthy, happy, and having a fabulous relationship with her parents. So that was in her 40s she healed that, and her parents were willing. And they were so amazing, you know, to care about their impact as adults. And I mean, this particular case that I'm referencing, I have pictures within the first hour and a half of this intensive where the daughter was tormented for 40 years with her rageaholic mother. The mother, who I did a few hours of work before she came, I just said, just care. Just listen. You don't have to agree with your experience. This is what she experienced. Within an hour and a half, the daughter was in her mother's arms, sobbing like a newborn baby at 40 plus, with the mother just holding her and rocking her. The care she needed back then was happening. And by lunchtime onward, it was all rewiring that happened so
Jeez.
Quickly, simply because 40 years of her mom never owning the impact of her abuse, because she was overwhelmed with her husband having an affair with his assistant and her rage from her own mother, and she had no support back then, took it out on her kids. And her remorse and her caring is all that primitive part of the adult child's inner child needs to hear, her genuine care, and 40 years of pain dissolved in an hour.
It's incredible.
So it's not necessarily, now if the mother wasn't involved, if the mother, which most parents aren't involved at that level, would it have taken more, you know, a year or two or three of this adult client working with me, in a sense helping her feel the impact of her parents and helping her become the adult loving parent for her child her parents never gave? Yes, that's what we call reparenting. Do you need an adult parent to be there? No, but if the person who hurt you cares, that healing happens so quickly, so much quicker than if you can't involve them.
It's good to hear those inspiring stories and show that hope is there and change is possible. And it just seems like the importance is the openness to the healing, no matter what age or position you find yourself in.
Absolutely. My 23-year-old came home over Christmas, and she was kind of funky with me. And I was going through a memory. I was in healing some of these childhood memories. Something got triggered, and it had been a long time since she'd seen me kind of under the weather. And I was really sensitive to any negativity. It was a really hard month, and she was just being kind of normal, you know, surly, independent young adult. And I cried. At one point, she wasn't treating me well, and I cried and go, honey, I'm in a really tough place. I'm really highly sensitive. It has nothing to do with you, but I just need you to be more gentle with me. And then she cried, seeing me cry, because she doesn't like seeing me, you know, together, mother, not together. Yeah. And I told her what was going on, age appropriate, with some of my memories. And it was, she was old enough to realize, hey, mom's human too. Mom has trauma too. Mom gets triggered too. I'm learning more as a young adult that my mom's, you know, I can impact her and I need to be sensitive to her, as well as I don't want her to be funky with me. I need to be careful and caring of her. So age appropriate, we're still working things out, and I'm teaching her how to be pro-relational and grow up to realize she can still hurt me, she can still impact me, even if she doesn't mean to, and teaching her how to be a caring adult. So that's a lifelong commitment I have to her, as my mom was there for me till the day she died.
Absolutely.
You know? And when I was in trouble in my early 40s in a relationship, I went home to my mom, and she was right there making me a priority, helping me through it. That's what secure love is. We're there for life, age as the children need us. We never outgrow the need. You know, Jordan, this is something you may have heard when we were, Lai and I were talking about the couples dynamics. The neuroscience attachment came up with, research came up with one major insight. 2,000 studies and 20 years of research about what makes a healthy, long-lasting relationship as adults, between two adults. We never outgrow the need to depend on someone and be interdependent with a go-to person in our life, hopefully becomes our primary partner. But that's what we needed as children, to be able to be independent. We needed someone to come home to and say, there's someone bullying me on the playground, and the parent goes, that matters to me, you're in distress. We are going to figure this out. And we never outgrow that need to have a go-to person in life, be it a primary partner, a sister, a best friend, a healer, a therapist, a mentor. That person is there for us 24/7, actually allows us to go out into the world, into the jungles of all the hyenas and the, you know, rabid animals and the scary people, and come home and say, I'm scared, I'm threatened. And the person goes, I got you. That's what intimacy is. I got you. Let's work this out. That's what interpersonal is. That's why if you don't learn that from a parent, at least one, or a primary caregiver, and you're depending on your phone to self-regulate you, you're not going to be able to really find well-being and self-worth off a piece of technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as long as you're doing a better job than the ones before us, we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
I hear my two-year-old shrieking in the background now, so I feel like that's a pretty good call, a pretty good wrap-up call. Thank you so much, Carista, for doing this interview. This has been wonderful, extremely enlightening, very fascinating.
Yeah, and sorry if I kind of riffed off on some eddies there of information. You gave me some big hitters there.
It was all very relevant. I love it.
Good.
And the Lifebook members are going to love it. So thank you. I do appreciate it, and I look forward to speaking to you in the future on many different subjects.
Yes, and all I'm saying is do the best you can and get help if you feel overwhelmed, and that makes you a conscious, caring parent.
If you ever start a podcast, you've got some listeners here. I'm sure that they'd love to tune in. So
I have started a podcast.
Oh, yeah? Is it going now? Or
it's being developed right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, stay tuned, everybody. I'm sure there will be a Lifebook Loves on that.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to your daughter's call for distress. And making
well, my wife's got her right now. I'm sure she's fine. But I think that it's maybe it's time for Papa
to
come on down. That's
You're listening, though. You
I see,
because if your wife hadn't gotten her, last thing, if she hadn't gotten her, then you getting off the call would become more of a priority. And you're listening.
Yeah, even if it's live.
For those calls of distress.
Right.
Always, because the child's needing help.
Yes.
Okay, dear. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Everybody listening, thank you all for listening. This is Carista Luminaire and Jordan River signing off, saying thank you so much. We'll see you next time on the Lifebook Member Podcast.
Bye.